Most High, I come to you giving you thanks and praise for keeping me in sound body and mind. I ask you to forgive me for all my indiscretions, all that I have done and all that I will do. I ask you to open me up, use me as your vessel, let my voice be yours. Speak your mission through me, allow the listeners to open up and receive it the way you intended. No holds barred. Use me.
I look at the news and I watch. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here. Very excited today to have back in our midst on Ubuntu Radio, Miss Ansi. Yay! I was doing some recent interviews and I went back and listened to some of our conversations. And you are a funny, funny person on the radio. It's a good radio chemistry. So I'm like, I gotta get her back on the radio, not just to catch up with, you know, your personal life, because one of the reasons I started Ubuntu Radio. One of the reasons I started Ubuntu Radio was to have conversations with people that I know, good conversations, and obviously you've done that. And if you check our history online, you'll see some, you know, wonderful interviews, insightful, but funny interviews. You know, you got me thinking about what it is like for an educated black woman to be out there dating and things like that. So that was Ubuntu Radio's first really series of important topics in my head was that, because you got me thinking about that. So I want to continue that conversation maybe in another episode, but now I want to talk about something a little different to remind people you're an educator. Mm-hmm. Working in North Carolina, you work with high school kids. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I want to talk about 2014, you know. When's the last time we talked, actually?
We talked right before The Second Best Man came out, which was
2013. So over a year ago. So yeah. A lot has happened in the year.
Yes.
And I want to sort of catch up with you. You know, when something pops off, CNN has a go-to person ready for a reaction.
Yes.
You know, I actually been told that in case the president dies or something, they already have a protocol in the newsroom as to who they're gonna call first, who they're gonna have on second. Nobody's died. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, sad to say.
Yes.
One of the reasons we're talking today is because there have been two horrific deaths that sparked a lot of outrage, a lot of discussions about, among other things, race in America, blackness in America. And so I wanna pick your brain about Ferguson, about New York City, about where your students are at, where you're at in terms of the discussions on race. So welcome, in a long-winded way, welcome, welcome, welcome back. Ubuntu Radio is very glad you're here. Let's just get into it. As a teacher working with high school students, what has been their reaction to the events in Ferguson and New York City?
I work at a school that is predominantly white, predominantly upper middle class. So sort of reactions from students of color, I haven't had the chance to observe closely, because in the course of my day, based on the courses I teach, I don't see as many as I would like to. And those I do see have not visibly reacted with their teachers. They, of course, have interpersonal conversations, and I'm sure perhaps at the lunch table or on the bus they're discussing it, but not in a formal way in class. One of the most pointed and intentional responses I had was from two young women that I've taught before. One in school and one in a supplemental academic program, but I was going to lunch one day and they came to me and they stopped me in the hallway and said, "Can we please talk to you?" And I said, "Sure." And they proceeded to tell me that they wanted to do something to respond, particularly to the events in Ferguson and in Staten Island with the lack of indictments against those police officers. And this was also right after the death of Tamir Rice. So they were very, very adamant in wanting to respond in some way at school. They're both artists and they had been talking in their art class about artistic responses to crisis, social injustice, art as activism.
Okay.
And so when they came to me, they were basically saying, we want to do something that shows our understanding, our personal outrage, but we also want to do something from a point of allyship, not in a way that trumps or seeks the role of victim. White people are not the victim in this. And we don't want whatever we do to make it appear as though we are. Standing in solidarity with people of color with their hands up saying don't shoot is one thing. A white person holding their hands up saying don't shoot is kind of redundant, because white people don't get shot by the cops with their hands up. It just doesn't happen. And they then asked teachers, and many of us were teachers of color, what we thought would be a good thing to do at school. How would responding at school be helpful? What could they do in a way that allows them to show their personal outrage, but also to stand in solidarity? And we gave them feedback and ideas, and they decided to have a die-in and to open it to whoever in the student population wanted to join them in this form of protest. Well, shit hit the fan. They advertised it on social media, and a couple of people, not many, but a couple of people who had clearly a lot of time on their hands just began to troll it. And I think this is stupid, and you shouldn't do it, and if somebody does it, I'm gonna kick them in the face if they lay down. And the kids did a really good job of trying to keep the conversation civil and to answer these objections with facts, with the understanding that they are just allies, this is one response, that this is completely voluntary, but as, you know, nameless, faceless trolls, which, shockingly, these people actually weren't. Some of these were kids I had taught in the past who had graduated.
With their pictures.
Yeah.
In the responses on Facebook or wherever.
Yeah.
I don't get that. I don't either,
but that's part of being 17. And so the kids were upset that there were people who would not feel the way they did and would not understand the need to respond in support and in solidarity. Parents became involved because of what they saw as threats, and they thought that this was fostering an unsafe schooling environment.
Wow.
And so the day that the die-in had been scheduled, we invited extra police officers to campus.
Ironic.
To maintain the safety level. And ultimately the decision was made to postpone it.
So what was the timeline between these two young ladies coming to you and saying, okay, what can we do, to the time when the postponement happened?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. And this is when, November?
This is early December.
Early December, okay.
And we're leaving for Christmas. They wanted to do it before we left for winter break, before Christmas. So it gets postponed, and the kids who, you know, didn't believe it should happen in the first place were very vocal about their joy.
In real life or online again?
In real life. Their joy about the fact that this had been canceled and nobody was going to come anyway. The kids who had organized the event were understandably upset.
What were the numbers at this point? So, I mean, you said there were two girls who initiated the effort. After those 2 weeks, do you remember about how many kids were
in
supporting
our,
them? 10, 15, more?
Yeah, in our planning meeting, there were probably 15 or 20 kids planning. There were far more than that planning to attend the die-in. This was just sort of the steering team. It was about 15 kids. But on that day, the day of the die-in, far more students had dressed in black and were going to take part in the die-in. Teachers as well. But
For those maybe who don't know what the die-in is, I'm sure, I mean, a lot of you have seen the pictures, describe what would have happened.
What would have happened is the students were going to congregate outside of the cafeteria. They were going to silently walk into the main commons area in front of the main office, where sort of the heart of the school.
Mm-hmm.
and they were going to, en masse, lay down silently for 4.5 minutes to represent the roughly 4.5 hours that the body of Michael Brown laid uncovered and unattended in the street after being shot by Darren Wilson. They were going to, in addition, wear signs and t-shirts that say things like Black Lives Matter, that gave stats on the number of African-American males who are killed by the police and the rate at which that happens, and statements of solidarity and support. So this gets postponed. Those kids who have organized this are very vehement that something needs to happen. In fact, one of my colleagues came to me and said, something has got to happen today. We still need to do something. So that day, it's postponed. One of my colleagues comes to me and says, something still has got to happen. It's got to happen today. There are adults in this building who are saying unconscionable things about the fact that it's not happening. These kids need to know that there are adults who stand in solidarity with them. I talk with my colleagues and they're like, something needs to happen. So, being who I am, I say, okay.
Miss Ants, you gotta get shit done, yes?
We're gonna get stuff done. So I use one of my planning periods and I just decide, okay. In the same way that teachers have stood in solidarity with our students on other issues, students anywhere on the gender orientation, sexual orientation spectrum, we have stood in solidarity with them and worn t-shirts that say, everyone matters. We have shown ourselves to be allies to students of whatever sexual orientation, religious background, so on and so forth. I saw this as no different than an opportunity for students to see that there are teachers who are allies. So I took my planning and I sort of ran around the building and said, okay, during lunch, at the start of lunch, we are going to congregate in front of the school so that the name of the school can be seen, we can be seen. We will take a picture, you can make a sign, you can hold your hands up in the hands up, don't shoot,
posture.
Position, posture. We will take this image, it can be posted to social media, and students can see that within your school, the people that teach you support you. That this was not something that fell apart and you were the only person who cared. There were far more teachers than I even knew about who wanted to, that I couldn't get to, which says something beautiful. For me, as a teacher of color, in a predominantly white school, on a predominantly white staff, to see the number of teachers, and it was empowering for me to see my colleagues, who I've always respected and thought of as wonderful people, to see them as allies in something that mattered so much to me personally. I let my principal know. I was like, heads up, this is happening, it's during our lunch hour, we don't have classroom responsibilities. She was completely on board and said, I'll be out there. The kids who originally planned the die-in were like, we're still gonna do something, we're coming too. And I was like, well, this is not a choice I am advising you to make as an adult here. But if you want to come out and see this, I can't necessarily stop you from doing that. So they were out there, the art club made signs. We stood in front of the school, the kids sang a couple of choruses of We Shall Overcome. We took a couple of images that were shared with the newspaper and on social media. After teachers took that picture, two of those students came to me and just expressed their thanks. It meant a lot for us to see our teachers out there, to understand that this was a big deal for us, to understand that our need to still do something and to stand with us, and they thanked me for that, which was an amazing thing, because as much as it was for them, it was for me also, as an adult in the building, working along with people who may not share my beliefs, to make mine clear, what I value, what's important to me, what I stand up for. And so it was a great day, and the really cool thing was getting emails and messages and conversations with other colleagues who were unable to be out there, who hadn't got word and wanted to be a part and wanted to find out ways that aside from their general class behavior and who they are, they can let kids know that they stand in solidarity with them, that they believe that Black Lives Matter, that they believe that the police should be held accountable for their actions, and that greater critique should be given to policing policies, at least when we consider how the police interact with minority groups.
We've been looking for the world to change. If you feel the same, then go on and say, if you're out there, sing along with me. If you're out there, I'm dying to believe that you're out there.
And moving forward, have the students talk about, well, we're going to form this committee, and we're going to meet every 2 weeks and talk about these issues, because 2014 has shown they haven't gone anywhere.
Well, no, actually, I think what it has revealed in our school, one, is I think my kids, a lot of them, understand allyship in a way that perhaps they didn't before. They have amazing teachers, and I'm not talking about myself, but they've got
She's
great.
She's patting herself on the back.
I'm really not.
She is.
They've got, I'm not.
Pat.
I'm not.
Pat. You're like young Einsteins, little Einsteins.
They have wonderful teachers who are amazing people and have enlightened them to what it truly means to be an ally. Because I think at 15, at 16, you hear about a cause and it becomes your cause. And often, particularly if you are a white person, there is a tension between how much of this is my cause and how much of this truly affects me. And I think at 15 or 16, when kids are, when their consciences, whatever it may be, if it's child soldiers, if it's homelessness, if it's social justice in regards to race, if it's gender equality and rights for the LGBTQ community, even if you don't quote unquote belong to that community, it becomes your story. And this is your fight. It's very important to understand when you say your fight, truly what you mean. Do you mean that this is a fight I'm invested in because I believe in this? Or have you confused the fact that there are true victims in this situation of which you may not be one? And so their pain and their struggle is theirs. And you empathize with that, but you may never truly understand it. Empathizing can go a very long way, and I think allyship is a powerfully important thing. It can move mountains, it can change conscience. Allyship can change legislation. Allyship is critical. But there's a difference between being an ally and being a member of that group that is being discriminated against, who is losing their lives, who is losing their livelihood. And I think kids and sometimes adults are so passionate about wanting to make their commitment clear that the line blurs and they don't always take the step back to say, how long has it been since I've listened to the voice of the people I'm claiming to help?
So that's why I asked, is there any plans to keep the dialogue, the conversation going, so there can be these exchanges that are really necessary? I mean, you said the high school is such where you deal, and specifically you are dealing with some of the most intelligent kids in the high school. Mm-hmm. So there's no doubt Ms. Ansi's teaching them the facts about what's going on, the facts of history. At least they have a base to start a conversation. But the realities of the conversation, the nuances of the conversation, the emotions of the issues are translated when you sit down and engage like we are doing now. So are there plans at the school for that to continue? Not just between the students, but like you said, it was a powerful reaction to have students come up to you and say thank you for doing this. So why would, but it seems to make sense that should continue.
Well, yeah.
Not teacher-led, but the teachers involved.
No, it is. Equity training for teachers and equity conversations are part of the long range plan for the district in which I work.
So it's no longer race. People would say that. There's not race anymore, it's equity training. It's not race training, it's equity training. So I sometimes have a not a problem, but an issue with people using that word, equity, when the reality is you're talking race. I mean, let's cut it to, we're talking race. But I understand why the conversation needs to be steered that way.
Yes, equity is the umbrella, but we also have a very pointed commitment to black and brown children and closing the racial gap that exists between black and brown children and white children.
Okay.
I mean, we can talk about equity as an umbrella because it covers a lot of subgroups, it covers a lot of underrepresented groups within a society or within a school. But within that, you also, in the same way that you have very specific notes for guiding a conversation, you also have to have specific points for guiding equity training. It's not sort of a, we are the world, let's all hold hands. It's, here's a specific group of people who are struggling. How do we address the needs of these kids? Which I think a lot of people in general are kind of uncomfortable with. They want to pull it back to economics and ignore the fact that race and class are one and the same in most places in our country.
So you're in a classroom teaching somebody, and some kid, white kid says something, or a black kid says something, and all of a sudden, you hear it, and you recognize, well, it can't be interpreted this way, but maybe the kid doesn't. You're in a classroom.
That happens generally more often with students of color and the things they say about themselves.
Really?
In mixed company. Yes. Most of the corrective action I've taken has been by students of color who will make sort of broad sweeping statements like, oh, Miss Ansi, you know black people don't XYZ.
Gotcha.
And you see white kids going, black people don't XYZ. And that's when I have to take the onus and go,
we don't dance?
Exactly.
Ballet. Yeah. We don't dance ballet.
You know black people don't do ballet. And I'm like, we're talking about people in your house. And the kids are like, oh. And I proceed to name five or six black ballerinas.
Please, go ahead.
Misty Copeland. And there's like four. There were four on the cover of Point Magazine.
Put you in the spot.
You couldn't deliver.
You couldn't deliver.
But I could in class.
You blanked out. This ain't class. This is real life. This is real life. Butcherade is real life.
It is real life.
Kind of disappointed that you couldn't.
I'm sorry.
There's Mitzi Copeland. There's Stella Copeland. That's her sister. There's Mitzi. And then there's Stella's like 3 years younger. And she's not popping off right now. But she's got a mixtape. A ballet stuff out? Underground stuff in Brooklyn. She was crumping. I talk about things like dance theater, Harlem.
I talk about things like the Alvin Ailey Company. I talk about the long history of dancers of color who were classically trained that exist.
Leroy from Fame.
There you go. I talk about Debbie Allen. I talk about dancers who are classically trained that perhaps
Turbo and Ozone.
From Breakin'. And break into
electric.
Yes. But those moments. Or
is that five? I think we just named five.
There you go. So a kid will say something of that ilk. And that's when I take that moment to sort of self-correct and go, well, actually. And I always make it a joke. I'm like, well, you might be talking about the black people at your house. Because in my house, we XYZ'd and we ABC'd and we went to, you know, LMNOP, we went all these places and did all these things simply to reestablish that an individual's perspective is just that we do not speak for cultures at large, especially young black men when you're in a room full of white people and you're the only black person they know. So it's one thing for you to act however you choose to act. You don't have to wear the weight of your culture on your shoulder at all moments. But understanding that you are the only person of color, you're also not going to, with absolute freedom, begin to speak about your culture in a way that may not be true for all people. So you can speak about yourself, but when you're the only black person in the room, you're the only black kids these people may ever know, sweeping statements like, oh, black people don't swim, go a lot further than you may think they do at 15.
Cullen Jones, NC State, by the way.
Indeed.
World champion, 50 meter freestyle.
Tim Duncan. Wake Forest.
We're not gonna, I don't know who that is. What was the response for you personally? I mean, obviously you did this, that was a response, but as a teacher, I'm thinking, okay, you're doing this to sort of help the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously you're doing it for yourself.
I'm doing it to help myself as
but
well. That's why
you
I teach
personally,
teach.
How did 2014, Ferguson, Staten Island, and what happened in Ohio, and the countless others that just went by the wayside. Mm-hmm. That was just a picture on Facebook, mm-hmm. or a mention on Google. How did that affect you? And we're gonna eventually get to the movie Selma, and you just saw that. I really want to talk about that, but the transition. So we mm-hmm. first talk about the kids. It's all about the kids. Mm-hmm. About the kids.
It's about the kids.
They are our future. The kids are our future.
Love them children.
But how did this affect you, Miss Ansie?
Well, I think like thousands and millions of other people, there's heartbreak at first. These are conversations that my mom had to have with my brother about how you interact with the police. My nephew is 7. And the idea that my brother will have to have the same conversation with him, and he's biracial, but identifies as black and registers as black to those who look, was heartbreaking. Like, it was the crushing thing that I thought of. Like, it made me viscerally take stock of, do I want to have children? Whatever their father may be, they're going to be black. It was a visceral gut check of what my life is going to look like. I mean, it directly impacted life choices. Will I choose to reproduce?
Wow. It went there.
It went there.
And when you came out of that?
When I came out of that, I was like, of course I'm going to reproduce. I miss Ansie. Like, if I don't reproduce, who am I going to leave it to? Like, some of the children I teach, that's scary. Okay. Like, I don't want them being the only people feeling my culture. Like, I need to make some smart black kids with two-parent homes, or, you know, to give us a chance. Like, I need to reproduce. And not just me, but people like me. People who are hopefully are moving our culture forward in thought and action and arts and athletics, whatever the case may be. You want the best and brightest to add to your culture.
And you say people, go ahead.
So I got over the whole locking up my womb. I got over that. And then there, of course, is a certain level of rage that you have to work through.
Did, like, you punch? Did you work out? What'd you do?
I went to church.
Went to the gym.
Hollered. I went to church and I went to the
gym. Hollered? A lot more screaming on those. Okay, that's a good one. What was the response in the most segregated hour in America? That 9 to 10 service on Sunday morning. What was the conversation there? Was it preacher led?
No.
Or was it just after walking out, the people were just, God?
No. My church is multicultural. It's probably 70-30 white.
Okay.
But significantly multicultural. I was refreshed, one, by the fact that I walk into my church and I look around and I see that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Gentile, but we are one people. And to see my pastor, who is a white man in his, you know, in his 40s, get up and talk about the fact that we have to talk about this. This is not in my notes. This is not what the scripture is about, you know, what the lesson is about today. But this is going on in our country, and black Christians and white Christians are seeing things very differently. And if we're not honest and open about those feelings, if we're not praying for each other, if we're not praying for our nation, if we're not expressing the fact that some of us are hurt and some of us don't understand why we're hurt, we're all a bunch of talk. We're sound and fury signifying nothing. And at that point I wept. Here is someone who could have chosen to ignore this. And with, you know, justification, well gone on with his sermon as planned, but is earnest and aware enough, and hopefully is Christ-like enough to know that I can't in good conscience. Just because it wasn't my son or someone who looks like me, or I may not fully understand it, I get to ignore it. So church for me was a balm for a lot of the hurt I was feeling. It didn't address it all, but it was, you know, in addition to like working out to sort of get out of the rage, going to church was very meaningful for me.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon.
formed against. Yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
2014 in general, the last half of 2014 was, I mean, it was nice to see what was going on. It was nice to see that Black people especially coming together and expressing a level of, not rage, but a level of frustration about not being fully treated as human beings 40, 50, 60 years after I thought we were done with all that stuff. I mean, growing up, I wished at 15, 16, 17 years old, when you have the energy, when you want to get up and move and do something, like, what would it have been like to be in Birmingham with the dogs and the police, or walking across that bridge in Selma and knowing that the horses are coming, that they're putting on their mask because the tear gas is coming, or that spray that knocks a little boy or girl over? What would I have had the conviction, would I have had the fortitude to go out there and do it? And you always think that, well, of course I would, but you don't know. You don't know. 40, 50 years later, you don't know. You do not know.
I don't know right now, today, having seen the movie and being moved by it, and I weep when I see the...
Well, the movie we're talking about is Selma. You've gone and seen it. I want to talk about...
Have you seen the courage of those people? I would like to think I have it. I don't know.
So the movie Selma stars David Oyelowo. Did I say that right?
Yes.
David Oyelowo. And another Carmen. Nigerian lady.
Carmen Ejiogo.
She's from Nigeria. They're both Nigerian British people. They're both Nigerian British people. Come to America and take jobs. Take jobs, but I hope they do a good job on this movie. I hope so. But the second Nigeria and from Britain and America. I hope they do. But Carmen's in it. Who's Carmen playing?
Carmen plays one of the local Selma advisors.
So who are the big names? Who are the big names that were there? Obviously MLK, what's the guy, John, he's a senator now.
John Lewis,
who played John Lewis?
John Lewis is played by, he looked to be a new actor to me. I haven't seen him in anything.
So who are the bold-faced names in history that were?
Well, Ralph Abernathy, John Lewis, Dr. King, Malcolm X makes a cameo. Coretta Scott King.
Who played Malcolm?
Another guy I was not as familiar with.
Are you sure you saw this movie?
I did see the movie. But you can see a movie and not know actors.
Not me. Name me something. Go ahead. Try me. Just try me.
Okay. What else other than Selma has David Oyelowo been in?
He's been in a lot.
For example?
Of movies. Mm-hmm. A lot of movies.
Yeah.
Now, you may not know these movies, but I know these movies.
What was he in?
He was in one of the James Bond movies. The one, Quantum of Solace, was it?
Okay.
He was in Quantum, was he? He was in Quantum of Solace. He was in Quantum of Solace.
Okay.
Actually, no, I have a scene. I have a scene in my head.
You don't know.
With David, no, I have a scene in my head, but I'm trying to remember the movie. I have a scene in my head where David Oyelowo walks into a room and he exchanges something with somebody, like a key with somebody, and then goes out. Actually, I don't have no idea.
I know.
So tell
you. And Lorraine Toussaint is in it. She's great.
Lorraine Toussaint, who's that?
She plays she's a character actor. She's been in a lot of smaller.
Name one movie that Lorraine Toussaint was in.
Selma.
Touche. Toussaint. So tell me, when did you go and see it? Like the weekend it came out?
I saw it Friday when it came out.
You, other people, you just went by yourself?
No.
And based on an earlier conversation, you can look back, the Ubuntu Radio, which theater? Did you go to? Because you have a thing.
I do have
a horror movie. You go to the black theater because they yell back at the screen and it makes you feel safe.
Yes.
Because you know in a horror movie that there are other people in the theater. Black people go, don't go in that door! Don't go in!
Yeah.
So what theater did you go see this? The white theater or the black theater?
I went to the mid theater. I went to the theater that's
very politically correct.
I did.
You went there.
But I organized a group of teachers.
Look at you. Teachers that were involved in the diet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So give us a little overview without spoiling the movie for people.
Well, the movie's spoiled by history, so you know what occurs.
But who reads history? Not these people right here.
It starts by showing the groundwork that was laid by the black people within Selma with the help of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It shows, which is one of the really amazing
things. Is
Stokely
Carmichael? Who plays? Is Stokely Carmichael? No, Stokely Carmichael.
But one of the
SNCC started in Raleigh, by the way, Shaw University.
One of the really cool things about the film is it does focus on, as much as it is about Dr. King and his efforts with LBJ, I love that it gives voice to people like Hosea Williams and Ralph Abernathy and John Lewis and local people like Mr. Jimmie Lee Jackson or James Reed, the Universal Unitarian minister who came down to march with them. But you see the real people who were involved in this work while Dr. King was, you know, a figurehead and a powerful leader of the movement. I like that you see that this was a movement of people, not one man.
Right.
And that is the thing I think that's most moving in the film. You see the personal commitment, the personal sacrifices, that real blood was shed by real people. That this wasn't, you know, a Cold War set of espionage battles back and forth. This is real blood and real lives.
How violent is the movie?
It's not.
Blood is blood.
Yeah. It's not 12 Years a Slave play. It's not Django. It's not a Tarantino film, mm-hmm. but it's, I mean, when people get shot, they bleed. When people get shit kicked out of them by a cop, they bleed.
How many times did you cry?
Aw, he would ask that.
And was the whole theater crying all at the same time?
I don't know.
Or your sisters, your teacher sisters that you took there?
My friends are multicultural. When I watch a film like this, at times it's difficult. There's one, my best friend in the world. We share a name. I can watch anything with her because I can react how I can react. She can react how she reacts. And I don't bear the brunt of assuaging her feelings at the end of the film if it's a matter of race or culture. Like, she can feel whatever feeling she feels about, you know, not necessarily responsibility, but, you know, perhaps cultural shame and the norms of the time without my having to go, but that's not you, and I know it's not you. Like, if she feels bad about what white people did, okay. It's not on me to then go, but that's not you. And, like, I don't have time to make you feel good. And she understands that. We do life together in such a way, she would never expect that. That is not always the case when you're watching a film like this in mixed company, particularly with liberal progressives who oftentimes feel more guilt about stuff that they shouldn't feel to begin with. So when you watch a film like that, they're feeling whatever guilt and they're looking for an outlet. I'm in my own feelings because these are my people. And this is, you know, the story of people in my family, and this is the story of my now. I don't have time to make you feel better, because right now I just want to hurt. And I'm not really looking for you to make me feel better. I just need to feel these feelings. They say what's happening, we say the facts, and then they lie. We coming back for them, they might say, but they don't know. They say.
Sing a nigga like
There is a scene where a protester is assassinated by the police. And of course, my mind immediately goes to right now. You know, this is supposed to be 1965 Alabama, and it's 2014, the United States of America. And it's this question of how far have we come and how far do we have to go? And, you know, the sort of signature song of the film addresses that idea of, this is why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up, the same very clear evidence of differential treatment and justice and access to justice if you're a person of color in this country. There's another scene where Dr. King is eulogizing someone who's died, and he talks about who bears responsibility, and he references white pastors who on Sunday failed to ever address social segregation or the problem of racism in our country, that they bear as much responsibility as the person who pulls the trigger. And it made me think about my own faith community and how fortunate I am. I won't say proud, but how fortunate I am to worship in a faith community where those conversations, difficult though they may be, are had.
Human beings in a mind. What's a mind to a king? What's a king to a god? What's a god to a non-believer who don't believe in anything? Will he make it out alive? Alright, alright.
As a woman, I was sort of reinvigorated and recharged by the portrayal of Coretta Scott King, the portrayal of Miss Annie Lee Cooper, who overplays in the film, and other women leaders within the struggle that you don't often, outside of Rosa Parks, get to hear about. And it made me far more interested to go back and read more about the work of those women. Because oftentimes, even at its best, movements can be both patriarchal and homophobic. And Byard Rustin has a strong presence in the early parts.
For those who don't know, Byard Rustin was a
civil rights man. Yeah, he was a gay man, okay. And a civil rights coordinator, but was ultimately asked to remove himself because of the threat of his sexuality becoming a detracting issue to the movement overall. But he was blood, sweat, and tears behind the organization, like on the ground organization of the March on Washington. From phone calls to lunch to signs to permits to coordinating, right. You know, that
unsung hero. He built the frame upon which Dr. King built the house, more or less.
One of many such carpenters, but it was really cool to see.
Good analogy. Well done, you little Jesus. Hey, look at you, man.
It
look
was really cool to see what he was truly doing, and people like him, Hosea Williams, another one of Dr. King's advisors in the movement. It was just amazing to see those. It truly made me want to meet John Lewis, like to shake his hand and read his autobiography. And
how young these people were.
Yes.
Their late 20s, early 30s at most.
Well, John Lewis was in his early 20s, because right. Dr. King was in his early 30s at this point. He's 33, 34.
How did John get involved? Because unless somebody who's been on the scene since then, he's now a senator?
Mm-hmm.
Or he's in the House. Yeah, he's in the House. And been there for a while.
Well, he was an organizer of SNCC, of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who initially were reluctant for Dr. King and his crew to come in, because they understood when he came in, the attention would turn to him and driving that. And they were more grassroots community activism, truly sort of changing things long term on the ground. And Dr. King was more strategic in, where does my face need to be? Where do we need to turn press and attention? And so there was a tension there. There's a tension there, but.
So was SNCC on the ground first?
Yes.
Okay.
At least in Selma.
Okay.
But it's just a beautiful film. It's Like I said, the thing that it did for me, I think.
Make me want to leave today and go watch the show.
I think for people who know nothing, it's an amazing and well organized, well versed representation of a really complex period and a powerful event in the civil rights movement. For people who are versed, it's a powerful catalyst to find out more about people outside of Dr. King. Even though he's a central figure in the film, if you know the period, you become far more fascinated by, oh my gosh, there's all these other people doing all these important things. I want to know about those people because many of them are still here.
Nobody wants to die. Nobody thinks that death is good for any reason. I'm not looking over the things that happened in Ferguson, New York. But then on the heels of that, this movie comes and says, like you said, how far have we really come? John Lewis, I'm thinking 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Probably got another 20 years. If he... These voices, these stories, being able to get these first-person accounts, that entire lineage of people will be gone in the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
They will be gone. So I almost look at it as the universe saying, please be reminded that what these people struggle for, it's still an issue that needs to continue.
Yes.
Their legacy is such that you must continue. Like, I've had this theory for a long time about race in America and the conversations that happen with race and the need, like when you said equity, I want people to use the word race because it's a harder question to tackle. It asks you to delve a little bit deeper into yourself. It brings up philosophical issues about fairness, not just about fairness under the law, the fairness in terms of your humanity, like those girls coming at you and basically saying, look, we feel this way and we need to express this to define something true to ourselves. It caused black man, white man, whoever got involved to dig into and try to express the best within themselves. What does America really mean to me? And if I'm willing to stand on a bridge, stand in front of horses, to stand in front of billy clubs and whips and chains and fire hoses and this America and this dream that we're trying to create in this place means enough for me to die for it. Not just on the field of battle someplace else, in Germany or Iraq or Afghanistan, but here. But here. So, 1960. 2014, was that 55 years later, the work that John Lewis started and seemed to kind of go underground, if you would, for 40 years. 40 years in the wilderness. This conversation on race is 40 years in the wilderness. And now these incidents bring it back. And this movie says it needs to continue. And your kids at your school recognize that.
Mm-hmm.
And you watching this movie and going home and to the gym and needing to work this out and wondering, do I really want to put a child into this kind of environment, into this reality? But ultimately saying, with a level of intelligence and caring that I can. Why? Because others have. And because that conversation didn't happen the last 40 years, I think America's worse for it. So I want that conversation to be voiced again. I want that, those conversations to happen at your school. I want those conversations to happen on popular media. I want them to happen on Facebook, on Ubuntu Radio, on podcasts. I want the conversation to happen, not because I want to instigate anything,
mm-hmm.
but because America is worth it, and America will be made better for it. I think that was King's dream. That's what Lewis is staying alive to see. And I think we owe him. We owe them, and we owe ourselves as human beings, as Americans living in a democracy that is still needing to develop and grow. We owe ourselves. We owe legacy. We owe history. We owe ourselves to experience that glory. We really do. I need to go see that damn movie.
You do.
I need to go see that damn movie.
You do.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours.
Our next talk, though, it's gonna be classic Miss Antsy Winterator about what you've been doing with yourself
over the past year.
Over the past year, and the men in your life. Funny, funny talk. Come on back. Ubuntu Radio. Miss Antsy, y'all, she's here. Next.
Glory. Oh. Glory. Glory.
Hands to the heavens. No man, no weapon. Formed against, yes, glory is dead.